Okay, so we've got a number of questions here, so I'll just sort out the English ones and the Sinhala ones. This one's in English. Okay. Okay, oh, this is a long one with two parts in it. Okay. So I'm trying, with the help of meditation, to be a mere observer of thoughts, etc. Thoughts, okay. Same as watching a film, trying not to get affected or involved. Okay, two questions. Why do different... Why... No, sorry, it's not... I've got... Do you know what that word is? Different something. Sorry about this. Why different something? Thoughts, is that? Yes. We're just having a consultation among the Sangha now to try to read this particular word. Okay. Is that was that what this is? No? Another question while we're working this one out. Are we advised to maintain a mahagata citta all the time? Well, I mean, when the Buddha is talking about the mind which is mahagata and apamana, he really, really meant it. Okay? Yeah? So measureless means really measureless. Yeah? So he's talking about a very profound and very inconceivable state of consciousness there, yeah? For when we're practicing, if we say we should have our mind which is like that all the time, of course that's a wonderful ideal, but the reality is that we're not going to be like that all the time, yeah? Until we're Buddhas or something like that. So the best thing is to think, well, how can I, in this situation, with this person at this time, how can I be kinder? How can I listen more carefully to what that person's saying? How can I consider what's in their interest and what will alleviate their suffering and do what's best for everyone? So just do you do like each time? Again, this is this idea of training. Very, very small things. Training little bit by little bit by little bit. There's a wonderful little example that was given to me once by one of the ladies who used to be my dayaka in the monastery in Malaysia, in Ipoh. And she's saying that she was doing the shopping for her family, and she came to two things, like whatever, brands of yogurt or something like that. And there was the one that she liked and the one that her son liked, right? So which one does she buy? And so she's doing the shopping, right? So she picks up the one that she likes. And then she thought, no, I should get the one that he likes, yeah? So she put that back and got the one that her son liked, yeah? And so that's the way you train. And you train little bit by little bit by little bit. You think those things are unimportant. You think every little choice you make is unimportant, but every little one builds up, and you don't know what amazing things will happen because of that. And the lady who told me that story is Ayahasapanya, who's now one of the abbots of Dhammasara Monastery. Yeah? So just be careful. If you make those do too much renunciation, you never know where you're going to end up. Okay. Different films. Okay, so this is you continuing that metaphor. Thank you very much for that. Oh, yes, you're right. Okay. So it's like you're watching thoughts, and the thoughts is like watching a film. Why do you have different films for different people? Okay, that's a very good question. It's like you have a narrative or a story that you're telling about those people. Okay, if you distance yourself too much, will you be less compassionate, especially about suffering of others? If not, it will be the other extreme of being too affected again. Walking a tight rope, or practicing to just be. Okay, so. It's quite a deep question there. So the question is, you know, when we're looking in meditation at our mind, you know, sometimes you have these stories. You tell ourselves the stories about people again and again and again, and so we try to be a bit distant from that story. But then, do we end up just being cold and hard, or if we get too engaged and too attached with it, then we can end up suffering too much? And this is an important thing to think about. And then the metaphor was used there, the metaphor of a tightrope. Are we walking on a tightrope? Yeah? Yes, we are walking on a tightrope, but the rope is not tight in the way that you're thinking that it's tight. The rope is tight because your mind is tight. Yeah? Because you're thinking, oh, I have to be like this or like that, and everything's getting tight. And you're thinking, I have to get this right all the time. But it's not like that. It's not like there's a perfect balance which you maintain all the time, right? Working on a tightrope, it's always like one thing, and I'm going to do that one thing all the time, right? But that's not what it's like. That's not what Dhamma practice is like. There's not just one thing that you do all the time. Sometimes you step back and you have equanimity. Sometimes you step forward and you act out of compassion. And sometimes you have that loving kindness. And so it's wisdom which knows what's appropriate at that particular time, yeah? So it's not that there's one solution for any of those things, but that when you do that, when you're in that situation, you do it 100%. And this is, to me, this is one of the greatest lessons that I've learned from staying with Ajahn Brahm. So of course, I'm sure you're familiar with Ajahn Brahm, and you come to his talks and things like that. But you know, I sit next to him at breakfast time, which means that A, I get to hear his jokes again and again and again. Which is also a training in letting go. But but one of the things, and other monks have been here, lived with Ajahn Brahm also, you can confirm or deny whether this is true, but one of the things that always struck me about Ajahn Brahm is that whatever he just did it 100%. Yeah? Whatever. If he's bricklaying, he lays bricks 100%. Yeah? And I remember very clearly one day watching him lay some bricks of doing some work at the monastery, at the kuti I was staying at, and they were building the walking path. And there's a bunch of monks and Ajahn Brahm, and they were working. Ajahn Brahm still does that. Like last year I was teaching a retreat at the Jhana Grove Retreat Center. The day we finished the retreat, he was on the roof fixing up the roof. So he still does this. So he was laying bricks with these other monks, yeah? And these other monks were all talking about formless jhanas, as it happened that day, right? Formless attainments and these very high things. Ajahn Brahm was laying bricks. Yeah? So they're all talking about these very high meditation states. Ajahn Brahm is laying bricks. And I'll bet that when they went back to their kutis afterwards, Ajahn Brahm was the one who was practicing those very high meditation states. And the other ones were still thinking about bricklaying. Yeah? This is the key. This is the key. This is sampajanya. This is mindfulness. Whatever you're doing, you do that 100%. If you're with that person, you give yourself to that and act with as much compassion as you can. When it comes time to let go, you let go as deeply and completely as you can. It's to be fully in what you're doing at that time. This is the secret. Okay, next one.
Yes. One question asks, if you choose to do loving kindness meditation, does it not include all other training method? And does it not lead us to even to the final bliss of Nibbana?
Okay. Yes. Okay. Does loving kindness include all other training methods, and does it lead us to the final bliss of Nibbana? Yes and no. There are many different aspects of the Buddha's path, and in one sense we can look at them as being distinct. In another aspect, we can look at them as being the same. I mean, if you want to look at, say, the five precepts, you can say, well, all of the five precepts also come from a place of loving kindness. Yeah, so we say not killing beings, we do because of loving kindness. Yeah, this is obvious. Not stealing, also. Loving kindness is involved, because if we really care for that person, we wouldn't take what's theirs. Yeah. Similarly with the third precept, kame sumvicara. If you really cared for that person that you're married to or whatever, then you wouldn't commit adultery or wouldn't sleep around. Yeah, and so on. So we can see that loving kindness is part of what we're doing in every situation. But it's still not the same. It's not the whole story. And so at the end of the day, loving kindness, metta, is just an emotion. And as an emotion, it is conditioned. Like every other condition, it's impermanent. Yeah? So that loving kindness will not be there, it'll be there for a while, and then it will pass away. And so to realize the deep parts of Dhamma is about understanding that, understanding the nature of these things. So in that sense, loving kindness is not on one hand can be considered to be included in everything in the path, but on the other hand, there's more to it than just loving kindness.
Right. Another question asks, what is the death? So that.
What is the death?
Yes.
Oh. Oh. What is the death? Okay. Simple, straight to the point. No messing around. What is death? Well, the Buddha always said, try it out and see. So you just try it for yourself. Everybody wants to know what death is and what happens after a life, but nobody wants to actually do the experiment. Yes. Yeah? Actually, we've all been born and died so many times. Yeah. Yeah. You know, the Buddha said that the tears we've shed in all our rebirths is greater than the water in all the oceans. Yeah. We've been born and died so many times, and yet somehow it's hidden from us. And really, the fear of death is about the fear of the unknown. And I think it's important to respect that and respect the fact that it's unknown. I remember one time several years ago, I was part of an interfaith panel, and we gave did some questions with some children at a school, now like high school kids. And then one of them asked the question, "What, according to your religion, what happens after we die?" Right? And there was myself, there was a Muslim imam, Christian, one or two Christians, Jewish, I think a Hindu, I can't remember. And every single one of them gave the same answer. Every single one of us gave the same answer. And our answer was, well, I don't really know, but this is what my religion teaches. Yeah? And I think it's very important to appreciate that. Yeah? Of course we have these teachings that the Buddha gave us. And I'm a Buddhist. I think those teachings are probably right. But the Buddha also said, don't just take everything on faith. Yeah? We need to investigate and to see. So we know that physically there are certain symptoms that happen when we die. We you know, the breath stops, the brain activity stops, the heart stops, the temperature falls, and so on. Everything is different. Everything that we've known in our life. We have our body here, everything's working. Then everything changes, and we don't quite know what happens after then. According to the Buddhist teaching of rebirth, our mind moves on, our mind becomes reborn in another place. What actually happens there? What's going on? Well, this is something that we can say from a Buddhist point of view. We have the teachings on karma and so on, and those teachings, In their essence, are very simple. Their essence is that good actions lead to good results, bad actions lead to bad results. Obviously, this is something we can observe to some degree in our lives. And the Buddha said that the same principle applies when we die. So our mind has this energy to it. Actually, the Buddha, you know, the Buddha was talking about the mind. He talked about this idea of sankharas. And the mind is sankharas. Everything in the world is sankharas. Sankharas just means energies. So these energies are conditioned. They're always changing. But we know, according to modern physics, so they have this idea in the laws of thermodynamics that energy is neither created nor destroyed. It's just transformed. So what happens when we die is this energy, the energy of consciousness, is transformed. And it doesn't disappear, it's transformed. That transformation is not different in kind from what's happening to you right now. Your mind is rising and passing away, different feelings are coming and going, thoughts are coming and going, moods coming and going, the level of awareness rises and falls, for example, when you go to sleep and then wake up. So these changes are happening to us constantly. And death is just another one of those changes, but just a bigger change, a much more drastic change, a much more complete change. So if we think of our mind as energies, and particularly we think of our mind as patterns of energies, this is a very powerful idea. Our minds are not just chaos. Our minds have a certain order to them. But that order isn't fixed, right? This is the idea of a self. An Atman idea is the idea that it's fixed, yeah? So our mind, there's nothing fixed or eternal, but there are patterns which tend to recur. Not exactly the same, but similar patterns, recognizably similar patterns. And these patterns are things like, you know, you look into your mind, you see the same thoughts tend to come again and again, the same interests, the same likes and dislikes, the same intentions and so on. And these tend to be similar. They change, they evolve gradually. And so that those patterns of energy take shape in a new form. This is what we call rebirth. And when a new individual comes to being, then they will have recognizably similar patterns. I read a study many years ago on identical twins who were tested while they were still in the mother's womb. Okay? They do like ultrasound on the embryos to identify, you know, the two embryos in the womb and to look at their kind of behaviors. And what they found was that even then they're genetically identical and in identical environment. So you ask, is it nature or nurture? Actually, it's neither, right? But they had distinctly different personalities, right? One was more active, one was more passive. And that was quite consistent in their behavior, and it was consistent when they were born and when they grew up. One was more extroverted, one was more introverted. That's not something that was because of their genetics, it's not something that was because of their environment, it's something which they had, I guess, because of their karma. Yeah? So again, that's a pattern of behavior which is being played out. Yeah? So death is a transformation of the patterns of the energies of the mind. That's how I would describe death. Okay, next question.
Sure. Another question. Bhante, please explain how to let go.
Please explain how to let go. I thought I already did that. Okay, how to let go. Okay, so first thing. You ring your employer and tell them that you're resigning. Tell your family you're not coming home. Leave all your possessions behind and walk out the door. That's it. Done. Easy. But if you don't want to do that, then perhaps another thing you might try is just practice with little things. Right? Now, choose the smallest and most trivial thing that you can think of. Okay? You're much better off to practice at something small and succeed than to practice at something big and fail. Yeah? Do something very small. I remember one Dhamma teaching I heard many years ago, one Dhamma practice I heard many years ago was about a particular group. I can't remember what the group is called now, but it's a particular group of in Japanese Buddhism. And they had this very, very strange practice. And when I read about this practice, I thought, that's outrageous, that's terrible, that's completely against what the Buddha taught. Because their practice goes like this, that when you come to the temple, they ask you, what do you want? And then you say, oh, I want a new Mercedes. And they say, fine, we'll give you a new Mercedes mantra. And you go home and you recite 500 times every day, I want a new Mercedes, I want a new Mercedes, I want a new Mercedes. And then you get a new Mercedes. So they're like, oh, they're right. They go home and they do that. I was thinking, this is terrible. How can people think this is a Buddhist practice? It's completely against everything the Buddha taught. But then they describe what actually happens. Well, what do you think happens? You go home, you think, I want a Mercedes, I want a Mercedes. What's going on there? Well, first thing that's going on is renunciation. What? It's renunciation? Yes, it's renunciation. Why? Because you're renouncing everything else that you want. Ah, you didn't think about that, right? You're focusing. You're saying, there's this one thing that I want, and I'm going to let go of all those other things without even noticing it. Yeah? Right? And that's, of course, the second thing is that actually it's often quite effective, because once you focus on a particular goal, right, and you're able to let go of your other goals, often you can achieve that, right? Good enough. So you focus on that goal, you do that, you don't spend your money on other things, you don't waste it on gambling or all the other things you might have wasted on. I really want this Mercedes. So you save up your money, you save and save and save, and you work hard, and then you can get enough money, then you buy a Mercedes. You drive it around, you feel really good. Oh, wow, I feel so good, I've got this Mercedes. Wow, now I'm really happy. Right? When you drive it out of the showroom, oh, it feels so good. That's real. And you just drive down your old street, you sort of smile at all the neighbors. Hi. Then you go home, then what happens, right? Then the wife says, oh, can we go down to the shop and buy some cabbages? So you say, all right. So then you drive your car down to the shop and you put some cabbages in the boot. And now this new car is just a device for shifting cabbages from the shop to your home. That's all. And within a day or two, it's nothing special, it's just a car. And you realize all the things that used to make you unhappy are still making you unhappy. So you go back to the temple and they say, okay, you've got what you want, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. This shows the wonderful power of the Dhamma. What now do you want? So you think about it. Do I want an even better Mercedes? Is that going to make me even happier? No, maybe, actually my children are finishing their exams up this year. Maybe I want my children to succeed at their exams. They say, okay, we'll give you a new mantra. May my children pass their exams, may my children... So it's something that's a bit more meaningful, isn't it? Yeah. So then that happens. And the next one comes along and you say, oh, what do you want? Oh, I realize I'm still arguing with my wife after all these years. I want to get along with my wife. Okay, so you do that. So gradually, as it goes on, gradually you realize you're refining what it is that you want and what it is that you're ready to let go of. Yeah. So this, I think, is a very important lesson in letting go. Letting go is not just about what you don't have. It's about choosing wisely what you do want. Because every time you choose, what is it that I want, you're letting go of 1,000 other things that you might have had. Okay.
Any other questions? Also asked in Sinhala, so that questions... you can translate.
Atharima tulin rattak ho pudgalek dilindu noan neda.
So, if give up everything or let go, then country or person may go to poor or poverty. Mm-hmm. So,
if you let go of everything, you'll become poor. Well, I'm very poor. Doesn't bother me. Like I said before, you know, there has to be a certain kind of basis of material prosperity, you know. And yes, there's genuine suffering if you don't have enough to eat, if you don't have a place to stay, if you don't have some security in your livelihood, health, all of these things. If you don't have a basic of those things, then yes, you will suffer. But once you have more, then it's not going to cause you to get happier. Our choice, if we were to ask this question, right, 20 or 30 or 40 years ago, right, then we might have been able to think at that time, oh yes, well, you know, we need more material things, we need to be wealthier and so on. But we can't do that anymore. Our world has changed. Yeah? If we continue the way that we have been, if we continue consuming, if we continue our materialist society, our world will collapse. Our environment is on a pathway to falling apart. And this will happen sooner rather than later. The predictions and projections for climate change, I'll be honest, I find it difficult to imagine that our civilization will survive in a meaningful sense beyond the end of this century without radical changes. Renunciation and giving up is no longer something which we do purely because we think it's a good thing and because we want to support our spiritual practice. It has become, and I think this will be increasingly recognized in years to come, it has become, I think, the most powerful thing and the most essential thing for the survival of our civilization.
One question, Nath. I am Panya Sami from Myanmar. You say mind is for thinking while meditation, but I understand is that meditation is for control of our mind. One question.
Okay, is the second question related to that or something else?
Yes.
Is it related or the next one is it different? No, yeah. Is it related or different?
This one.
Okay, different question. Okay. Okay, so the first question is, shouldn't we be trying to control our thoughts in meditation? Fine, if you want to control your thoughts in meditation, please go ahead. Good luck. And I've been meditating for 20 years and I've spoken to lots of people who've meditated. I've never found anybody for whom that's been a successful strategy. What is the basic teaching that the Buddha's teaching in the Anattalakkhana Sutta? Yeah? Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vijnana, Anatta. Yeah? Why? We can't have of them. We can't say, be like this, not be like that. Yeah, we can't say to our mind, be like this, be like that. This is what anatta means. You cannot control. This is what I learned when I was in my first retreat in Thailand, when they talked about anatta and they explained anatta to ourselves, to the students. The very first time I ever heard anatta explained, he explained it as cannot control. Yeah, this is what anatta means, cannot control. So if we go in there and we try to order the mind around, who is ordering the mind around? The ego is ordering the mind around, yeah? The self, the I, is ordering the mind around, ahankara. This will never lead to peace, yeah? At the very most, what you can do with that is you can contain the mind a little bit, right? You can get a sort of a temporary sort of feeling of peace and relief by structuring the mind a bit more. So yes, in the short term, you can have a bit of success, but ultimately, that will be very limited and very shallow. Yeah? The real depth in the mind comes from understanding and letting go, from looking what is the causes of thoughts, not trying to control the thoughts, but looking what is the causes of them. The causes of the thoughts, of course, is greed, hatred, and delusion. And so we learn to let go. Don't worry about the thoughts. You learn to let go, and then you find the thoughts are not there. Thoughts are conditions. We don't have to make them go away. They will go away by themselves, right? They're conditioned, they're impermanent, right? The important thing is not, how do I make the thoughts go away? The important thing is, why do I want to keep on creating the thoughts, right? What is there in me? What is that need, that drive that is causing those thoughts to keep on coming up and up and up and up? When you are content and you're happy, then there's no need for those thoughts to keep coming. They'll go away by themselves. Okay, next question.
You say when we take meditation, noise is no problem. But I understood if we need silence, please. Please explain, sir.
Okay, so obviously having a nice quiet place to meditate is good, yeah? I like to say in a nice forest monastery. I was up in the monastery I can't remember the name of it last night, anyway, up in the hills, and it was beautiful. It was so lovely and quiet, and it's so wonderful to be there, yeah? So that's great. It helps. It's the external conditions, they help, yeah? But the most important thing is being able to let go. And if you can let go, you can find peace anywhere. And I had an experience a couple of years ago in Australia. We have a movement that, actually it's a global movement that we call MedMob, right? And MedMob is basically a bunch of young people who organize themselves over Facebook and so on, and they come to meditate in public spaces. So they just find parks and things like that, and they just go and meditate there. So we have like 100 people, 200 people just coming to sit meditation. And we organized one year a MedMob in Sydney. And this was organized on Sydney Harbour, just next to, there's a park near the Opera House, right? That sounds like a wonderful place, right? It's a park, it's an opera house, all of these things, except the council told us to sit on the side of the park that was next to the freeway, okay? So there was noise from the freeway and stuff. But also, it just so happened that week they were demolishing the steps of the Opera House. So there's all these big machines out there, bang, 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 and these kind of big drills and jackhammers and so on, this noise going on. It was incredibly loud. And we're sitting there thinking, I'm going to have to sit here and meditate with this noise for the for the next hour. So I said, okay, I'll just meditate on the noise. Don't try to get rid of it, don't try to shut it out, I'll just accept it. And so I just sat there and listened to all the sounds coming from the city, the sounds coming from all these machines and all of that stuff. I just listened to it and you just let it wash over you and let it go through you. And you find it was a very, very peaceful meditation. You're just not resisting any of that until you find you're completely at home and completely content with all of that sound.
Okay. Other questions? Please, could you tell us something more about bhikkhuni ordination? Can Sri Lankan bhikkhuni get ordinated here without going abroad? Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So, the second question is, I think, easy. Yes, bhikkhunis can be ordained in Sri Lanka without going abroad. In fact, usually the bhikkhunis from other places come to Sri Lanka to get ordained, yeah, from Thailand and from overseas and so on. So, yes, there are bhikkhuni ordinations these days, I believe held somewhat regularly, although I'm not entirely sure. Perhaps there might be others who are more familiar with what's actually happening with that. So I was just asked to speak generally about bhikkhuni ordination. I don't know, it's such a big topic, it's difficult to summarize it all briefly, but for those of you not familiar with the basic history, when the Buddha, during the Buddha's lifetime, he established an order of bhikkhunis, and this order was very successful and flourished, and we have some wonderful teachings in a book in the Pali Canon called the Therigatha, which tells the stories of and the verses of many of the enlightened nuns at that time. The Therigatha is a very astonishing piece of literature because it is, I think, perhaps the earliest, or certainly one of the earliest pieces of women's literature anywhere in the world, and is, I think, also the earliest piece of women's... the earliest piece of women's spiritual literature anywhere in the world. Pretty much. There might be one or two things that are earlier, but that's pretty much. As with so many things we find in the Pali Canon, we have a spirit of authenticity and vitality and realism in these stories we find in the Therigatha, which often speak to the experiences that the women had in those days. And one of my favourite verses from the Therigatha is from Mutha Theri, who said she's freed from the three crooked things, from the mortar and the pestle, and from my crooked husband. So it seems that the experiences of women in those days perhaps wasn't so different from that of women today. And so this order started. Now, all the indications are that order of bhikkhunis flourished in India for a long time, and recent studies have been done on that which showed that in the inscriptions, that is the physical records of Buddhism in India, we find mentions of bhikkhunis approximately the same number as we do for bhikkhus. Okay, so bhikkhus and bhikkhunis are mentioned about the same number of times. This is in the inscriptions in various stupas and monuments and records in India. And not only that, but they're mentioned in similar roles to those of the bhikkhus. So we find bhikkhunis mentioned who are Tipitaka dharas, who are learned in the Tipitaka or learned in the suttas, or who are vinaya experts, or who are sponsors who've led groups of people from another state, another country in India, to come and build this stupa or build this railing or something like that. And these donations are recorded. So the bhikkhunis clearly played a powerful and leading role within the Buddhist community. And that's not just an isolated reference. That's generally across ancient India for more than 1,000 years. I'm sure you all know that Bhikkhuni Sanghamitta brought the Bhikkhuni order to Sri Lanka in the time of King Ashoka, who was King Ashoka's daughter, and brought the Bodhi tree with her. And the order of bhikkhunis flourished in Sri Lanka for well over 1,000 years until the records kind of peter out about 11th or 12th century. We don't quite know what happened to the bhikkhunis around that time, but it seems that there was some social unrest and the bhikkhuni order didn't survive that. Meanwhile, however, bhikkhuni ordination was taken to China in 433 AD by a ship owner called Nandin and a Sri Lankan bhikkhuni called Sara traveled to China where together with a group of other Sri Lankan bhikkhunis, they performed the ordination there and established the bhikkhuni lineage in China. It's important to understand when we're considering this question of lineages, this is something that I wrote a book about and I did a lot of research on, that there's a distinction in Buddhism, and there always has been a distinction between what is the form of Buddhism or the doctrine of Buddhism that you're teaching or practicing and what is your ordination lineage. So in the Mahayana countries, in the East Asian countries, the ordination lineage is from what we call the Dharmaguptaka school. And Dharmaguptaka is essentially a variant of Theravada, which had become established in the northwest of India and from there travelled to China. So the ordination lineage of Chinese, Vietnamese, Korean and so on, Buddhism is essentially the same as that of the Sri Lankan Theravada lineage. And it's no doubt because of that that the Chinese and the Sri Lankan Vinaya masters considered it appropriate to perform that ordination with the Sri Lankan bhikkhunis and Chinese bhikkhus. And this is all recorded in the Chinese history. Now, one of the things to remember is that once the order was established in China, it then flourished there for a long time. Now, China, for that entire period, was one of the, if not the, largest and most stable and most advanced civilizations in the world, okay? And whereas Buddhism, we find in Southeast Asia, sort of came and went and was lost and had to be re-established and so on, in China we had a continuous tradition of Buddhist history from that time or from earlier down to the present. And so in the present day, when there was a revitalization of interest in the Bhikkhuni order, this revitalization of interest stems from at least the early part of the 20th century. We find, for example, that Jetawan Sayadaw, who was Mahasi Sayadaw's teacher, wrote an essay in Pali where he mentioned that the bhikkhuni ordination was being a lively topic of discussion among monks of his day, which I think was the 1940s or 1950s that he wrote that. And he proceeded to write an essay where he defended the bhikkhuni ordination and explained why that it was possible to perform that according to the Pali Vinaya. And so in the present day, of course, we've had the re-establishment of the bhikkhuni order beginning in the 1990s. One of the first Theravadan bhikkhunis, if not the first in modern times, was Aya Kema, who's a German woman who, in fact, lived in Sydney and was the first trustee of the monastery I lived in at Santi Forest Monastery. And so Aya Kema was a remarkable figure who lived in Sri Lanka for many years and was one of the pioneers in Buddhism in many ways. But more recently then the bhikkhuni ordination has been established strongly in Sri Lanka and also is becoming much more widely accepted within Thailand. And I believe that there's probably 100, maybe 200 bhikkhunis now in Thailand. And they've started performing the ordinations as well. So, as I've heard, that they've previously had come to Sri Lanka to have bhikkhuni ordinations, but now the Thai bhikkhunis are doing their own ordinations there. And so this process is gradually going on. Also in Indonesia, we have bhikkhunis, in Cambodia, Malaysia, and Australia, of course, all of the traditional Buddhist countries like Australia have bhikkhunis there. So so this is something which I think is absolutely essential. I think that we all understand that discrimination is wrong, that it's wrong to treat people as lesser or less than fully human because of their gender. It's just wrong. And the Buddha had the wisdom and the compassion to empower women to be able to practice their spiritual life to the fullest. And we should follow his example. It's wrong to use the Vinaya to stop people from practicing the Dhamma. It's just wrong. Yeah? The Vinaya isn't there to prevent people from practicing Dhamma. The Vinaya is there to empower people to practice Dhamma. If we look at how the Buddha set up the Vinaya and how it is structured, right from the beginning, the Buddha is giving the power and the authority to the Sangha to govern themselves. Right? The Buddha wasn't a control freak. Okay? He wasn't telling you, you do this, you do that, you do the other. He was about letting go. We have to give the bhikkhunis that same support and that same encouragement and to empower them to make their own choices. and to find a way of living as renunciates in our current world, in the same way that the monks have had, we've had our chance to find our way to work out how to live and to practice, and we need to support the bhikkhunis to be able to do the same thing.
හොඳයි මම ඉස්සෙල්ලා එනම් සිංහලෙන් කියන්න ප්‍රශ්නේ අතහැරීම අල්ලා ගැනීමට වඩා පහසු නම් ඇයි අපිට බැරි භාවනාවේදී අපේ සිතට එන සිතුවිලි බැහැර කිරීමට ඔබ වහන්සේ සඳහන් කළා සිතුවිලි පිළිගන්න ඒවා සමග සිටින්න කියලා බන්තේ now in your talk you mentioned that to accept the feelings just be with the feelings so if it is the case why is it so difficult for us to get rid of the thoughts which arises while we are meditating why is it so difficult to let go than grasping to them
Thoughts are not something that arise. Think about how we're using language here. I'm not sure exactly how the sinhala was, but in English we often say, "Oh, the thoughts were arising." Yeah. Look at the way that we're using language. The thoughts are arising. It's a passive voice. Right? It's saying that here I am, and those thoughts are coming and hassling me. Yeah, they're just arising. They're just some objective phenomenon that has nothing to do with me. Yeah? What's going on there? Why do we talk about thoughts in that way? Yeah? Because we've dissociated the thoughts. We've disconnected ourselves from them. I'm in here. I'm pure and good. I'm a good Buddhist and I'm a meditator and I'm in here meditating and oh, that's so wonderful. And all these thoughts, they're coming and they're doing nasty things to me. Oh, that was a nasty thought. Ooh, I don't want to have that thought. Oh, that thought was something else. It's arising to me. It's disturbing me. It's coming into my meditation. Yeah, it's coming and disturbing me. Me, I'm in here, I'm good and pure, and these thoughts are nasty and they're coming at me like flies coming. Right? That's what that language reveals. That's how we think about meditation, that's how we talk about meditation. But as soon as we make that conscious, then it's obvious that that's not what's happening at all. Right? That's not what's happening. Thoughts don't happen to you. You create the thoughts. You make them. Thoughts aren't a thing. Thoughts are a behavior. Thoughts are what you do with your mind. Right? Yes? Yeah. Thoughts are what you do. And it's not that you're pure and the thoughts are coming and disturbing you. Greed, hatred, and delusion is the roots of the mind. We all have that greed, hatred, and delusion. So first of all, let's accept that. We have greed, hatred, and delusion. That's humanity. That's where we are. But deal with it, okay? Right? And those thoughts will come up. They will arise, not objectively, not as something outside ourselves, but as something that we do. There's something motivated from inside us. So when we reflect about it in that way, we realize that we have to take responsibility for these thoughts. We have to care for them. Yeah? Not reject them and not push them away, not try to get rid of them, but accept them and take responsibility for them. So if those thoughts are coming from greed, hatred, and delusion, what do we do? Well, greed, letting go. Hatred, love and kindness. Delusion, wisdom. Yeah? So rather than trying to push those thoughts away, this is what we use. We use letting go. We use loving kindness. We use wisdom. And when those things are in the heart, then we won't be bothered by the thoughts anymore. Okay.
හොඳයි ඒක සිංහල පරිවර්තනය කියනවා නම් සාමාන්‍ය සාරාංශ වශයෙන් මම කියන්න උත්සාහ කරන්න උන්වහන්සේ ඉස්ලාම ඒ ප්‍රශ්නෙම්ම උන්වහන්සේ අවධානය යොමු කරන්න කියලා කිව්වේ දැන් මට සිතුවිල්ලක් එනවා කියලා කිව්වහම එතනදී මේ මම මෙතන ඉඳලා බලාගෙන ඉන්නවා ඒ සිතුවිල්ල මගේ හිතට එනවා ඒ වගේ යම් වෙන් කිරීමක් අපි ඒ භාවනා යෝගී විදිහට භාවනා කරද්දී නැත්නම් සාමාන්‍යයෙන් අපි සාමාන්‍ය ඒ විදිහට වෙන් කිරීමක් විදිහට අපි සලකනවා ඒක ඒ වුණත් උන්නාසය කියන්නේ එහෙම මේක මම මෙතන ඉන්නවා මට සිතුවිලි එනවා මේ සිතුවිලි හොඳ ඒවා මම හොඳ බෞද්ධයෙක් ඒ වුණත් මට මේ එන සිතුවිලි මේවා හොඳ නැහැ මේවා හොඳයි ඒවා කියලා ඒ ආකාරයෙන් මම වෙනම වෙන් කරගෙන ඒ විදිහට ගන්න නෙමෙයි මේ සිතුවිලි කියන්නේ වෙන සිදුවීමක් නෙමෙයි ඒ සිතුවිලි කියන්නේ යම් ක්‍රියාවක් ඒක විශේෂයෙන්ම උන්වහන්සේ මතක් කරා එතකොට මේ සිතුවිලි ඇති වෙන්නේ ඒ අපේ තියෙන යම් යම් නැඹුරුතාවයන් නිසා ඒ කිව්වේ උන්වහන්සේ ඒ වෙලාවේදී විශේෂයෙන් මතක් කරේ මේ රාග ద్వේෂ මෝහ ආදී වශයෙන් තියෙන අපේ තියෙන නැඹුරුතාවයන් මත ඒ සිතුවිලි හට ගන්නවා. එතකොට මේකට අපිට බේරෙන්න බෑ මේ සිතුවිල්ල මට ඇවිල්ලා කරදර කරනවා කියලා. ඒ වෙනුවට අපි ඒකට වගකීමක් ගන්නවා යම් කෙසේ. මගේ හිතේ තියෙන යම් නැඹුරුතාවයක් ප්‍රවණතාවයක් නිසා මේ සිතුවිලි හට ගන්නවා. එතකොට එහෙමනම් අපිට ඒ සම්බන්ධයෙන් යමක් කරන්න පුළුවන්. අපිට රාග සිතුවිලි අත්හරින්න පුළුවන්. ద్వේෂ සිතුවිලි අත්හරින්න පුළුවන්. මෝහ සිතුවිලි අත්හරින්න පුළුවන්. ඒකට විරුද්ධ ධර්ම තියෙනවා. රාගයේ සම්බන්ධයෙන් ඒක අත්හැරීම. ద్వේෂය සම්බන්ධයෙන් ගත්තහමත් නැවත ඒ මෛත්‍රිය ආදී වශයෙන් මෝහයට ප්‍රඥාව කියලා ඒ විරුද්ධ ධර්ම ආකාර තුනන්සේ මතක් කරා. ඉතින් කොහොම හරි අන්තිමට මේ විදියට පිල් දෙකකට බෙදාගන්නේ නැතුව මේ தত্ত্বය ඇවිල්ලා තමන්ගේ හිත ඇතුළෙන්ම ඇති වෙන ක්‍රියාවලියක් කියලා තේරුම් අරගෙන ඒකට ඒ தত্ত্বය බාර අරගෙන ඒකට යම් දෙයක් කරන්ඩ ඒකට යම් හිත පුහුණු වීමක් කරන්ඩ කියන එක තමයි උන්වහන්සේ මතක් කරේ. ඉතින් ඒක නිසා දේවල් අල්ලා ගැනීමට වඩා දේවල් අත්හැරීම කියන එක අපිට මුලදී බැලුව බැලමට අපහසුයි. ඒ වුණත් මේ දේ වෙන් කරලා ගන්නේ නැතුව ඇතුළේ මේ අපේ තුලින්ම ක්‍රියාත්මක වෙන දේ ගැන කල්පනා කරලා සක්‍රීයව ඒ දේවල් අත්හරින්න කියන එක තමයි උන්වහන්සේ මතක් කරේ.
Okay. Thank you, Venerable Sirs. Now can I invite the Vice Chancellor of this university, Professor Atula Senaratna, to make a presentation to Venerable Sujato, please.